There was a time when today's guest was clear that he was all the way on top. He was an NFL player, life was good, and then it wasn't. Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I'm very pleased to introduce you to today's guest, former pro football player King J. Barnett. Today, he spends his time as a business person, an author, a mentor, an international speaker. You have gone very far from the Green Bay Packers. Jay, welcome to Mind Talk.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, Jay, you heard me describe you. There was a time in your life when, I mean, it had to feel like the world was spinning around in lovely circles. NFL, Green Bay Packers, lots of notoriety. Life was good.
Yeah, I mean, from the outside, looking in, think life was good because, you know, here I was with the opportunity of a lifetime. And just trying to kind of, you know, navigating through this journey. And I had been out of college at this time for a year, and I was a free agent, and I've gone the Arena Football League route. And now I finally had this opportunity to get back in the NFL because I, you know, worked out for several teams. And, you know, I went through the whole, you know, after the draft journey, and that didn't work out. So at this point of life, I think life was, you know, presumably good for me because I felt that I was finally at this place where I was getting the opportunity that I, you know, had dreamed of for years.
Let's go back a bit. I just want to help our listeners kind of walk through the earlier parts of your life before the NFL experience. You grew up in the 80s in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was life like as a young black man in Mississippi in the 80s?
Life for a black man in the 80s, growing up in Mississippi, it was a time where you kind of knew your place. Looking back, I feel like, you know, so many times that our position as a black boy, you know, was kind of already created because you knew where you could go and where you couldn't go. You know, as you know, racism was very prevalent in those times. I can remember going into a store where, you know, the cashier or the attendant would say, you know, go ahead and grab whatever you're going to get, boy, and get out of here. So that was norm. And, you know, we were sort of reared in a way that, you know, you respect white people and you say yes, sir, and no, sir, to them. And these good people, you know, allow you the opportunity. So you kind of grew up in a space where the environment was controlled and sort of influenced by so much racism. So there was no opportunity for me any freedom to be who you were or be who you are, to be yourself. And that's what I can remember growing up in the 80s. And as a kid, I saw that. I saw people being controlled by fear, being controlled by racism. And that was something that I was able to detect at an early age that I just couldn't get with.
Did your family talk to you about the fact that you were black and male and living in America and what that meant?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So my grandparents were sharecroppers and so on. My grandpa were connected to many of the white sharecroppers in Mississippi. And so my grandfather was an entrepreneur. And he was well known, so he was a businessman. He was known as growing, you know, the best fruits, the best wheat field. I mean, he had many workers, and so the dynamic that he presented and that my grandmother presented to us, whom I spent a lot of time with growing up, and they lived on a farm, and you know, they had chickens, and you know, they had hogs, and all those different things. So. The perspective that they gave us is that, you know, it was a privilege for us to be able to live this life that we had that was at times kind of seen as if it was afforded to us by the white.
Okay.
And And it was almost as if the whites have allowed us this opportunity to eat like this and to live like this and to be able to do all these different things. And if it wasn't for the white man, we couldn't do this. If it wasn't for the... So the perspective is what they showed me that I captured from the experience was that as a black boy, you know, if you didn't have the white man on your side, you didn't have a chance. And that's how I think. You know, kind of interpreted now from all of the messages and just from the conversation that I would even hear with them communicating with my uncles and, you know, with my other relatives is that, you know, the white man has afforded us this privilege and we should be grateful. And if you were going to go against that, that was a great opportunity that you was going to experience, you know, some consequences or some lashback.
So you had to be mindful of the people to whom you owed, it sounds like, almost your very existence.
Oh, yeah. We had to be mindful of that. You know, you had to be mindful that, you know, at Mr. Jim Ayers, that's this is crazy because I still remember the farmer name that my grandfather worked with, Mr. Jim Ayers Bobo. And that was the name that when that name was spoken, I mean, there was such high, you know, respect and high reverence for this guy. And it's just, you know, so if you did not respect him or you disrespected him, I mean, it was frowned upon. And so you had to be very conscious. And, you know, it goes back to, and I guess where I'm at now and to understand how, you know, we were not slaves and we were not, restricted. You know, there were some boundaries and some lines that was drawn in the town because, you know, the town was segregated. You had a white side of town and a black side of town. But it's almost like you look at a people that were not bound, but they were still bound mentally.
Indeed.
And that was the mental atrocity that I saw, you know, as a kid. Like, you know, man, Mr. Jim and Bobo controls everything. And that's literally how the atmosphere was set, is that he controlled everything. And he controlled it without actually being in the same vicinity as we were.
So a very powerful entity indeed.
Right.
At least right. That's what you were taught.
Right. That's what we were taught.
So living in that environment where your life you were taught was so much at the pleasure of this particular person, how did you begin to think about football and develop a wish to become an NFL player? How did that occur?
Well, my father, so I grew up a PK. My father was a pastor. He's one of eight boys, and my father was very athletic, and he was known as the one that kind of set the precedent for, you know, playing football. So my cousins had, you know, had played ball, and they had went on to college, played in the NFL, or currently as I was coming up, and my uncle had did so as well. So for me, I had kind of adopted this image that, you know, this is who I wanted to become, because as a Barnett, that's what you did. You know, you were athletic. You worked. The name was strong. The community knew Barnett. The town knew Barnett. So, you know, you represented not only just this dominant presence of a male, but also, you know, you were athletic. And you know, you were able to showcase your ability. And so for me, that's what I wanted to do. And for my father at the time, he was my idol. He was everything. There was nothing that this man could not do in my eyes. And I felt that, you know, he was the strongest man in the world. And all I wanted to do was just be, you know, be just like him. And so I can remember times that, you know, I wanted to become a preacher and just play football, just like my dad. And it wasn't until my parents divorced that football really became something that I really connected with, because it was a place that I found a lot of acceptance. And also I was able to find my place within society, outside of society, if you kind of understand that.
Sure.
It was just, you know, my safe haven, because, you know, after my parents divorced, my mother moved up to Texas. And so for me, it became, you know, this big brother to me that I didn't have, you know, able to have the camaraderie of teammates and other guys that you were able to share the same passion and able to share, you know, the same experience and same struggles. And that's why football became dear to me. Because as a kid before then, I liked playing football, but I didn't love it. And it wasn't until after the divorce that I became to love it. Because now football had replaced what my father didn't give me.
So football for you, it was so much more than making money and playing games. It was your life.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Football was, for me, going to the NFL was never about money. It was never about status. I really could care less about those things. It was just everything that the game brought to me. The game brought peace. The game brought joy. The game brought the strategic thinking in sort of, you know, maneuvering through life's challenges. And I enjoyed making adjustment, and I enjoyed the preparation, the weight room, the watching the film. I enjoyed everything that football represented. But on the other side of it, I also enjoyed the violence of it, you know, being able to hit. Being able to release my frustration, my pain, my anger. So it was everything. And when the game was over, oh my gosh, it just left me sort of almost just left me crippled, because outside of that arena and outside of that space, I didn't really know anything else. And I didn't want to know anything else, because, you know, football was, once again, it was like a father. I found, you know, other father figures in my coaches, and my team had become my big brothers, because I'm the only boy. And so, you know, I was with girls as a sister. I mean, we're having sisters, and, you know, they've always kind of had their own relationship. And so I always kind of felt like a loner. And so when I would go to football, it was, you know, sort of like gave me that opportunity to sort of communicate and kind of interact and engage with other, you know, young boys, and they kind of share, you know, some of the same experience that, you know, that we all thought about. But, you know, here we are, we're able to live out, you know, those things that we sort of imagined.
You know, as I listen to you describe all that it meant to you, I'm actually learning as well, because what football is portrayed on the television, obviously, is a bunch of guys running around playing a game, making huge sums of money and having big parties. And that's kind of what you see on television. And you don't,
right.
at least for me, and I think for many people like me, you don't think about the familyhood, the brotherhood, the teaching how to think strategically in a world where strategic thinking is so necessary in order to survive.
Right. Absolutely. And I think it sort of goes, you know, unnoticed that we are very intelligent people and very intuitive as well. Because, you know, even some of my studies that I've done in my master's program and studying how football players are able to make decisions about 8 seconds more than the average human being, because many of our decisions have to be made in high-stress environments. And so just even with just a study like that that I've been able to break down, and how we're able to sort of depict on how we're going to make a decision in the midst of so much chaos. And when you look at people on the outside of football, they're not able to make a decision just in, you know, a regular working environment. So, football, it encompasses so much more than what the eye sees, because, like you say, many people look at it as just entertainment. But for many guys, it is a way of life. And as for myself, it was a coping mechanism. Many guys have not had the ability, have the resources, the opportunity, or even just the knowledge to even understand who they are outside of football. So football has been able to identify a lot of our men, and especially for our Black boys, because for one, it's a sport that we can play that does not cost a lot of money. Is something that, you know, a young Black boy can really grasp fast. It's not like baseball, which is a very expensive sport. It's complicated. Basketball, you know, probably along the same line as football. But football has a lot to offer, because for many of us young African-American boys, we do have a lot of anger issues. And our anger issue stems from many of us not having male figures or fathers in the home. And so a lot of our anger is attached to the resentment, and the resentment is birthed from what we didn't get. And football has coaches, and football has position coaches. And many times as a young Black male, these position coaches become like fathers. They begin to speak into our lives. They begin to speak to our destiny. They begin to speak to the places that we've never had awakened. You have someone that is believing in you. You have somebody that is asking you, how are you doing? How was class today? You know, how's mom? How's the sisters? And how, you know, so football is so much more than just the entertainment side of it. And, you know, you could talk to some guys and they would tell you, this coach was like a father, man. This coach stepped in when nobody else believed in it. This coach believed in it. I can go on and on, and to this day, that's why my respect for the game and my admiration for a lot of these African American men that had the opportunity that I had, and or they weren't able to, you know, maximize the opportunity, or it just didn't work out. That's why I have a heart for athletes, especially in that arena, because many of us have to move on without having actually identified with who we are outside of that arena.
I see. The idea that the coach, particularly the position coach, is so so valuable and so important to a young boy, a young man's emotional growth and well-being, his strategic thinking growth and well-being. Again, I think you bring a very important and human awareness to the importance of football that, again, I would suspect that many of our listeners who are not engaged in sports would not have otherwise thought of. So thank you for that. There was a time, Jay, when despite all the happiness that football brought to you, despite the learning and the awareness and just sort of the general enhancement of who you were as a human being, that changed. And football was not a part of your life in the same way. And your whole world kind of took a tailspin. We're going to take a break. But when we come back, I would like to pick up with that. Ask you this, Jay, because you've said a number of things that I couldn't agree with you more. We don't think about much and certainly don't talk about enough. You talked about being depressed as a child, and very often adults don't think that children are depressed. I think we have more awareness now than then, but not enough. And you talked about cutting yourself. And typically when there is conversation about children, about people cutting themselves, it's that girls cut. We don't talk about We don't think about the fact that boys cut themselves, and you could actually kill yourself and maybe not intend to. For you, what did cutting do for you? Why cut yourself?
Well, it's almost, I know you know this as well, so it's almost one of those things, just as much as you're in pain, but the fact that you are numb to the pain is what the cutting represents. So there's the emotional hurt that you feel from the and for myself, it's the absence of my father. It's the actualization that my family was broken and was, you know, sort of disrupted by, you know, so I felt outside influences at the time, you know, from my father's own infidelity issues. But then on the other side of that, you know, all of the emotional pain that I'm feeling, right, there was another side of me that wanted to inflict physical pain on me, and the fact that I can cut on myself and I can bleed, and in my mind I was so I become such a callous individual that the pain that I was inflicting physically, it did not hurt because I was so numb to it. And for me, it was just like, you know, yeah, you feel it, but you don't feel it. And it's one of those things, it's psychological, because you do feel it, but the story that you're telling yourself is that you don't. But it's all a cry for help.
King J. Barnett, one day a football player and then not. Jay, what happened?
Oh, gee, I think after the whole Green Bay experience and even that phone call that they were going in a different direction, for me, is for the first time in my life, is that I was not accepted into this place that I had held at such a high level of respect and regards, and something that I struggled with as a kid sort of revisited me at this time. You know, I struggled with depression as a kid after my parents' divorce. I struggled with cutting on myself and really, you know, indulging into a lot of self-inflicted pain and self-harm. And I really just, you know, wanted to just really not be here. And because, you know, here I was, this is what I dedicated my life to, you know, the past, you know, 8 years, high school, college, just football. And to see some of the guys that I had played with in high school continue on in their careers. And, you know, and here I was, not unable to continue my career, and knowing that it wasn't so much that, you know, this person or that person was better than me, but it was this questioning myself, why wasn't, you know, I accepted? And I think that's what a lot of time that we struggle with as men is being accepted into places that we really long for. You know, when you look at how many men are wanting to be loved by their father and wanting to be, you know, accepted by a woman, or wanting to, you know, we don't deal with emotion, we're not as resilient in emotion as women are. So things hit us very deeply. And in this place, for me, you know, emotionally, I was just kind of torn apart, because, you know, here I was now having to find out who I was, and I was left to my own vices, and the suicide thing and the depression thing, they all revisit me, and I began cutting on myself in my bedroom and just, you know, wanting to take my life, because here I was looking for an answer to a question that, you know, I don't think had an answer for me, and because it was just life. Oh, and looking back on it now, you know, you look at 1,500 players come out every year for the draft, and I think maybe about 259 of them are actually drafted from the first to the seventh round. Then you have maybe a couple of hundred of, you know, free agents, which are not, you know, guaranteed jobs. So you're looking at a lot of people that are without work, you know, if football is the goal. And many of us, you know, sort of stare down this barrel, you know, kind of, you know, with these questions that, you know, what's next? And for me, I didn't know what that meant. I didn't have an answer to what's next. Me, you know, my what's next was death. so to speak, at that time. And that was a dark place that I found myself in. I ended up surviving that cutting incident and being able to come out on the other side of it. But and a lot of that, and if I can speak on this, is that, and this is why it's so important, you know, for us to talk about mental health issues and just talk about disappointment, pain, anger, hurt, and trauma, and all those different things. And especially for the younger people, because what happened is that whatever coping mechanism that we develop in those early stages, in those formative years, if there's nothing to come in and really shift the perspective and change the trajectory of how we're making our decisions and how we're behaving, they just grow with us as we grow older. And what happened is that things that we did in a past life, or should I say not past life, but in previous years,
yes,
they will become the same tactics and same things that we sort of revert back to as adults. And that's what happened to me after football failed. Because for the first time in my life, I had to accept the very game that I loved did not love me back.
As we come to the close of our conversation today, I just want to share with our listeners a quote from one of your books, Finding Our Lost Kings and Queens. You make the point that the king is the most important piece of the game, and moves must be made in such a way that the king is never in check. I'm assuming you mean the king or the queen. I know that's not chess, but what do you say?
Right,
what do you say to that?
For my perspective and for the penmanship on that particular quote, when you look at our society, the king being the most important part of the of just life in general. And of course, you know, in chess, we all know the queen is the most important piece. But I liken it to the king being, because in this game of life, that king determines so much about how the community evolves. It determines how the world perspective. There's a great responsibility on us as men. And so that's why my heart for these young boys, and not just black boys, but just boys from all races and all walks of life, is because the more that a boy can identify with who he is and what and who he can become, it allows him to develop a sense of identity beyond himself, meaning that another generation can only learn from the previous generation, but that's all attached to what is giving to the current generation, and that is determined by the male. When you look at the kings of old, and when you look at even King David, everything about David, right, was attached to what Solomon was going to become. And so the important part, and I can go into a whole different lesson than that and teach a lesson, but there's so much attached to the decisions of men. Because here's what I want to leave with the listen. A mother will determine how you feel and what you remember, but a father will determine what a child believes.
Terrific. Again, King Jay Barnett, thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Folks, thank you for joining me today, for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a mental health, medical health, or other professional. You can listen on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can download the Mind Talk app from your iTunes or Google Play Store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening today, so do send an email to me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. You can also send your questions or comments to me at Pamela at mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Thank you. Thank you.